You're listening to the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse at bellydancegeek.com. Hello, everybody. I'm Nadira Jamal, and welcome to episode 45 of the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse. This episode is sponsored by Alia Thabit, who is the author of the upcoming book, Midnight at the Crossroads, Has Belly Dance Sold Its Soul? And if that sounds familiar, it should, because Alia is a former Clubhouse guest who talked about some of her early ideas before she really got into writing this book. So Midnight is a love letter to the dance, an exploration of its creative, healing, spiritual power, and a map for dancers to find their true style. You can check it out at bellydancesoul.com. The Clubhouse is a place where dancers can get together and geek out on all of those things that are hard to get in classes and on DVDs. If you want help with the what, so things like moves and combos and choreographies, it's really easy to find resources. But if you want help with the why and the how, so things like culture, business, stagecraft, composition, ethics, all of these things can be a little bit harder to find. So every month I interview a different guest expert on a different geeky topic. And we always have time for questions and answers so you can geek out too. So if you think that knowledge and creativity go together like chocolate and peanut butter, you are in the right place. My guest tonight is Hiba. As an Arab Canadian, Hiba has always been intrigued with Middle Eastern dance, music, history, and art, which has led her into a journey of self-discovery. She began her training at a very young age and has grown to become one of Canada's leading Middle Eastern dance artists. She's directed two dance studios and fitness facilities, directed a professional dance company, and has taught and performed all over North America, as well as being invited to Europe for seminars. She's been featured in several instructional DVDs, a documentary highlighting the controversy of Oriental dance in Arabic societies, and was the host of a local television show entitled Experience Babylon that touched upon all aspects of Arabic culture from dance to cuisine. She's also host to seminars from dance and music artists from all over the world, including Ontario's very first Middle Eastern dance and music festival, Roxfest. She says, "I'm thrilled to share my Arabic heritage with men and women all over the world, and through hard work and dedication to the art form, hope to change the negative conception of Middle Eastern dance within its own culture." Her organization, Belly Love, is devoted to providing you with courses that are authentic, inspiring, warm and encouraging, and personalized. You can find her on Facebook at facebook.com/bellylovewithhiba. So welcome, Hiba.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here. It's been a long time in coming.
I know. I'm so happy to have you.
Thank you.
So before we jump into the meat of our interview today, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got started in belly dance?
Okay, for sure. So it's a little bit of a different story. We came to Canada from Iraq when I was a couple years old. And so I grew up Canadian without so much of my Arabic heritage being, you know, aside from like, you know, the food and like the music playing in the background. But I didn't really grow up feeling very Arab. And I also didn't grow up. Now, this is, I'm not going to give you the decade, but it was early enough that, you know, I wasn't really so accepted as a Canadian, just being, you know, sort of a minority myself. So I was kind of at a crossroads, sort of this in-between space between not knowing who I was as an Arab and not knowing who I was as a Canadian. So I wanted to kind of get in touch with my roots to discover who I would become, if that makes sense. So the best way for me was to, you know, the first thought obviously was, you know, well, belly dance, like how, you can't get any more Arab than that, you know, and this ties into what we're going to talk about a lot later. You know, so I wanted to kind of discover that side of my background. And so, you know, the moment I had that in my head, I was walking up the road in my little hometown and saw a poster because nothing was on the internet back then. So I saw a poster and was like, oh my God, it's meant to be. And I was so excited and, you know, just started classes right away. It came very, very naturally to me. And, you know, within a year, I was teaching with my teacher. So, you know, it happened very quickly. Now, she was trained in Egyptian style dance. So that's what I focused on in the first part of my dance career or my dance journey, I should say. But the interesting thing that sort of happened, which I think is really important because I think it'll like kind of highlight a lot of why we're talking about this in general is, you know, I was trying to find myself as an Arab, but I discovered very quickly that by going into a dance form that was not viewed as a strong part of the culture. And what I mean by that is it was a sort of the underbelly of the culture. Like, no good girl would go and belly dance. That's not how you become Arab. That's how you become ostracized from the society. I learned that very quickly because I remember this one time, and I'm kind of digressing here, but I remember this one time, I just learned how to do a three-quarter shimmy walk. I was so excited, and I went to my dad, and I was like, look what I learned today, and I started doing it, and he had this kind of little chuckle where he was like, oh, like, surprised that I could do it, but then he said, "Matastahin," which in Arabic means, aren't you ashamed of yourself? So it was like this weird, like, whoa moment of like, oh my gosh, who am I now? So I'm like learning how to become this awesome dancer so that I can become, you know, more Arab, but I'm not being accepted by Arabs. You know what I mean? So anyway, that's sort of how I started. After that, I'm sorry, I digress a lot when I started.
That's
into
usually
it.
When we get to the good stuff, so don't be shy about that.
Just stop me anytime, because I can go on for like ages and ages about every subject. So, but yeah, so I was a teenager at the time. Started teaching at the University of Guelph, which is my hometown in Canada. And that was sort of my first real brink into like teaching. From there, I opened up a dance studio when I was 19. I was in university at the same time. It just kind of skyrocketed from there and started, you know, teaching dances. It was a full-time job while I was going to university. After I was, about 5 years into the dance studio, which was very successful at the time, I'd been teaching workshops all over Canada at that point. I decided to take a little bit of a hiatus just kind of focused on teaching workshops and that sort of thing while I finished university and, kind of figured out if I wanted to like keep dancing, because again, it was a very kind of a difficult road for me as an Arab, because I wanted to kind of keep doing it and keep going through this journey, but I felt kind of stifled by the culture that I was trying to mesh a little bit more with. Do you know what I mean? So it was interesting at the time. So after that, a couple of years ago, I guess like 5 years ago now, I went back into it full time, opened up another studio in Guelph that was pretty successful. And then, you know, just really love teaching workshops and traveling around and, you know, kind of inspiring women that way. So I moved out west to British Columbia, and here I am now. So I still teach workshops and that sort of thing. I have my Belly Love course that will be starting shortly, just kind of doing it that way. So that's sort of the short version of myself.
Awesome. Now, the topic that we decided we were going to talk about today is cultural appropriation. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about why you took an interest in that and why you decided that would be a good topic for us?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, so to kind of put it into perspective, I'm Iraqi born, all right, but I do Egyptian style dance, right? And I do Hecha style, which is the Iraqi gypsy dance, but I'm an Arab, I'm not a gypsy. And so when I was going into my own journey, I had to be very careful of the path that I took in terms of like not insulting, you know, the genres of dance that I was trying to go into. And so I think for me, because it's so personal, it's such a personal experience where I'm trying to connect with my background, right? And I think everybody who starts belly dancing, you know, is trying to find some sort of connection to themselves, which is why they start dancing, whether it's body image, whether it's, you know, whatever the case may be. There's something about this dance form that really speaks volumes to people, right? And for me, just sort of having sort of the background that I do, where I am Arab, but I'm doing very different dance styles than like what my, you know, Iraqi brethren would normally do, right? So that's sort of the reason that I'm interested in it, just because I had to learn to tread very carefully in terms of respecting the cultures that I was even going into, right?
All right. Well, we're going to jump in, but before we go too much farther, you know, I just want to make sure that everybody understands that, you know, you obviously have a really important perspective to share with all of us coming from an Arab background as you do, but you know, nothing, we don't want to put you in the position of trying to speak on behalf of all Arabs. You know, that's not anything that one person can do every community, every culture has a lot of variety within it. And so, you know, I do want to point out that, you know, you do have a perspective that, you know, a lot of, you know, non-Arab Westerners can learn from and don't share, but that we're not expecting you to give us any kind of, you know, final statement on what all Arabs think.
That's much appreciated. Yeah, I never claim to know that I know everything. And I think that's, you know, this is going to be an ongoing discussion for years to come. Everybody's got an opinion on it, right? So my perspective just comes from my own experience. And, you know, we'll just, yeah, we'll see where it takes us with the call and the conversations that happen from here.
Excellent. All right. So, you know, what is cultural appropriation? I think, you know, at this point in the last year or two, we've all seen the term floating around a lot. But mm-hmm. how would you explain that to folks?
I think if we just sort of break it down, cut it into the very short version of it, it's when any type of cultural activity or artistic expression or something that's very deeply ingrained into the fiber of a culture is taken and adopted, if you will, by another culture. Okay, so for example, you know, for a long time there were, you know, people using bindis as like jewelry or makeup, that sort of thing, which in a sense is appropriating the culture, is taking an element from the Indian culture and applying it to, you know, your Western fashion statement or something like that, right?
And how does that differ from appreciating or participating in the culture or the culture's art forms?
I think this applies to a lot of things that I teach in my seminars is about educating yourself and sort of bypassing ignorance and that sort of thing, learning the music, learning about the culture, that sort of thing. So, you know, being appreciative of the culture or participating in the culture means you also understand the culture, right? So if you were to, you know, go into belly dance, I see this all the time where, you know, you might be using a song that is traditionally done in a folkloric style. Like Saidi is used a lot for this, where, you know, you might use Saidi music that's very traditionally folkloric, but wearing a full bedla. And, you know, the rhinestones and that sort of thing. And that's because of not really being completely educated on the type of dance that you're doing or the type of music that you're using, in a sense. You know what I mean? So I think appreciation and participating also comes hand in hand with education on what you're actually using, what you're doing. That's where sort of that fine line gets crossed, where people start to become offended by, you know, certain things and start to call it cultural appropriation, right? Because it might be like, you know, in the 20s when they did blackface, that was cultural appropriation because they thought it was hilarious to do blackface and, you know, sort of poke fun at the cultural group, right? Does that make any sense?
It does, yeah. So you mentioned Saidi. You know, are there some other ways that this plays out in the belly dance world or in Western culture in general?
Sorry, you just broke up there. What did you say?
Sorry about that. So you mentioned, you know, using Saidi out of context. Are there some mm-hmm. other ways that you see that this plays out in the belly dance world or in Western culture in general?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I think fashion is a big one, right? So, you know, if we're just talking about Western culture in general, you might see... you see a lot of like Indian inspired fabrics, right? That are, you know, put into like, you know, a design for a shirt or something like that. Or Chinese dresses that are used, you know, that are, I guess, traditionally used for like weddings and that sort of thing where people are using them for Christmas parties or going out. Bindis are a big one because I think if I'm not mistaken, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but my belief is that, or my understanding is that bindis are an indication of, you know, somebody who's married or, you know, engaged or that sort of thing. And people use them for fashion, for makeup here, right? For sort of that little extra little bit of bling on the side. And actually kind of referring back to bindis as well, when belly dancers, you know, are wearing their full bedla and then they've got like, you know, an Indian sari as a skirt and then they've got, you know, a bindi on their forehead. And, you know, it's that's sort of where that line is kind of crossed, because they're intermingling many different cultures just for a lack of understanding. It's sort of that exoticism, that orientalism that comes into play when people are thinking about belly dance, or that sort of, what's the word I want? That image, you know, of that glamorous, you know, Hollywood belly dancer that comes into your mind when you're first thinking about belly dance, or the little pasties that you're thinking about, or whatever the case may be, right? And everybody just wants to wear those costumes. And so you go and you find, oh my gosh, I found this awesome sari, I'm going to turn it into a skirt. And it's, you know, now we're intermingling cultures, right? Which is not necessarily a bad thing if that's intentional. Like you see belly dance with Bollywood music, but there's like elements of, you know, Bollywood fused into it. And that's where we have like the beauty of fusion and, you know, all of those different things. But when it's, you know, an Egyptian song, it's a Saidi song and a sari as a skirt and a bindi on the forehead, then it's like, where is your knowledge of the actual culture that you're trying to appreciate? It's not there because you're not appreciating the culture, because you don't understand the culture, right? Mm-hmm.
Now, you mentioned orientalism, and I know that's another word that people may hear a lot but not really understand. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, of course. So orientalism is a very kind of old word how do we explain this? Okay, so in, I believe, the Victorian era, when the Silk Road opened, there was a lot more exposure to, all things exotic. Okay, so you had a lot of access to Persia. So you'd have like Persian perfumes, and you'd have access all down through the Silk Road to China, where you'd have, artifacts that were Chinese. And so Orientalism became this exotic idea for like fashion, for home decor, that sort of thing. And it became this almost faceless way to, it's such a hard concept to say out loud, like, you know, and I know what it is, but it's sort of this this way of sort of showing off all of the different cultures from the East without truly understanding them. So, you know, when you see like Buddhist statues in somebody's home, but nobody's Buddhist, right? That kind of thing. Mm.
So like a stereotyping of it without exoticizing it without digging deeper.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. The stereotype, that was the word I was missing. I was trying to grasp it.
Excellent. Now, you know, one of the things that you talked about was, that you touched on, was that, you know, all art borrows from other artists, whether that's
Absolutely.
In your own culture or outside. So, you know, what makes something, you know, natural artistic growth versus unfair appropriation?
I think, again, it comes back down to education. So if you're taking something from a culture that you're trying to, you know, quote unquote, make better, but you don't really understand the culture itself. That's where sort of that line is drawn, right? So basically, if, for example, you were like, I really like Egyptian music, but I don't like dancing to it. I need a little bit more of a techno beat, right? That's where like fusion kind of comes in. Right? Maybe you feel a little bit more comfortable with those steady beats. Maybe you feel a little bit more of an understanding and awareness towards it. So I think it's like where you are taking the information that you understand from another culture and basically merging it with your own, right? So I think that if there's that basic understanding of the culture that you're kind of fusing in together, then that's different. If you're fusing it in with your own culture, I think that's where the appreciation comes in, right? So, and what I mean by that is, what I was talking about earlier, where you might take Arabic culture and Arabic music or, a belly dance style of costuming, right? But then you don't really understand it. So now you're mixing it in with like the Indian sari again, to use that example. I hate to use the same example over and over, but you know a little bit about like Bollywood dance. So you're like, okay, so I'm going to put my sari along with this. And then you might be thinking, oh, well, you know what, like Arabs have a tan, so I'm going to go and have a tan as well. It's just like this sort of mishmash of cultures where it becomes muddied, as opposed to really highlighting and expressing each individual part of it. So I think like fusion is really solid when you can clearly see what's being fused, and that the person who's combining those two elements together truly understands them, so that they can portray that to their audience, right?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, what role do power dynamics play in how all of this works out?
Okay, so this one's an interesting one. So, you know, like everybody has sort of their own voice, their own opinion on this, right? So certain people might have a little bit more say. Like, not a lot of people know who I am, right? Like, you know, I get asked to go to workshops and that sort of thing, but you know, like my opinion is relative to the next person's, right? But there are certain other, you know, dancers or professionals that have maybe a little bit more say, and so their kind of word is, you know, the be all end all, if that makes any sense. And so mm-hmm. I think that that's where a lot of this controversy comes into play, because you're hearing so many mixed reviews. I tend to stay like fairly neutral when it comes to cultural appropriation, because everybody has their own opinion and everybody has sort of their own experiences behind it, right? But I think some people really are like, well, my teacher said this, so this is the way it has to be. And some people, you know, kind of really fight against this concept of cultural appropriation, because maybe they don't want to be, you know, they don't want to be exposed in a sense, you know what I mean? Like a lot of people have been dancing for 20, 30 years, but maybe haven't had the same kind of opportunities that we do in this modern world to, you know, go and explore and like, you know, travel around and study with masters and that sort of thing. And so I find that a lot of times, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you have a different opinion, I totally respect that. But I think that a lot of times there are people that have been doing it for so long and are so set in their ways that they have, you know, such a following behind them that sometimes maybe their word is the be all end all for certain people. And so there's no growth and no sort of expansion beyond that, or no questions around it, you know?
Mm-hmm. All right. So we talked a little bit about, you know, whose voices get heard when it comes to creating the dance. You know, how about when it comes to who's consuming the dance, or who's vetting it and saying this is good and this is bad?
Oh, that's such a hard question to answer, because there's no real, you know, standard for this dance form, right? It evolves so continuously, and I've seen it evolve, you know, quite a bit in the last 20 years, you know, since I started. And, you know, in the last, you know, 75 years since I came into Hollywood, and you look at sort of the costuming that's been adopted in Egypt now is completely based on Hollywood, whereas before it was completely, you know, folkloric styles of costuming. And, you know, we didn't use pop music, you know, even 20 years ago. It was just some Kalsum, and that's about it. You know what I mean? So, you know, in terms of the people who are exposed to it, I think it's, you know, people are seeing pop artists take elements of belly dancing. You know, I remember when I started my first studio, that was about the time that Shakira came into North America, and everybody wanted to be like Shakira, right? I don't know if mm-hmm. you remember those days, but
I do, yeah.
Certainly do. Oh my gosh, everybody wanted to be like Shakira, and like, you know, I remember students coming to me like for their first lesson being like, I've learned every single one of her moves. And you kind of have to like be like, okay, well, guess what? We're going to unlearn all of those moves and start from the basics so you can understand, you know, where this is coming from. And so, you know, just taking that example, the people who are who are being exposed to the dance are completely being exposed by, media and that sort of thing. We're a little bit lucky now because we have, you know, a lot of really easy ways to kind of get correct information, just going online, asking different people. A lot of people are not like stuck with one teacher all the time, and they're constantly going and trying to explore. And so I think that's where it's changed, even over the last 10 years. But in terms of exposure, I think for the most part, everybody thinks that they're a dancer, right? So you probably have seen this. Many of you guys listening probably have seen this a lot over the years, where, you know, you might start to, you start a class and you become attached to your teacher, and you're only exposed to one thing, and that seems to be right because that's your teacher. You've paid money. That's your mentor. You admire this person, and everything they say has to be correct because otherwise, why are you doing it? Right. Mm-hmm. For me, my experience was a little bit different because when I first started, I already understood the music, already understood the language. And when I started to dance, my teacher was amazing, but I was pretty young and I didn't have the opportunity. And by that, I mean, my parents wouldn't let me go and like travel to other cities and, go and study with other teachers. So I was very limited in that sense. So I ordered video, VHS after VHS. I'm like so aging myself in this call. Damn it. but I ordered everything that I could get on my hands on. I like scoured the internet when it came about, and I ordered magazines, and I spoke to people, and I, spoke to other Arabs about what they had experienced, and I, watched old movies, old Egyptian movies, to kind of understand the, what the greats were like, and, who the singers were, and who I wanted to dance like, and who I wanted to be like, and that sort of thing, right? So my experience was a little bit different in that sense, that I didn't have the same kind of easy access that many of the new dancers would have, right? Mm-hmm. So in terms of exposure, that's a thing. Now here's the other thing, just kind of getting a little bit more controversial here, the people who are consuming belly dance, for the most part in North America anyway, and I find like most of the Middle East is pretty westernized as well, but in North America I think that a lot of people who are, hearing the words cultural appropriation are like, no, well, just because I'm white or just because I'm from North America, how could you say that I don't have a right to experience your culture? And, I'm trying to like showcase your culture and bring it out and this and that, right? But these are also the same people that, will go into a nightclub and they'll be chosen over the Middle Eastern woman or the Black woman. And, and I think that's sort of where a lot of the controversy comes in, is like, this image of belly dance is now this like, pristine, like, alabaster woman with blonde hair and blue eyes who's like, showcasing the dance form in a better way, so to speak, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, like, nobody has a better, I've seen incredible, like, one of my favorite dancers of all time is Yasmina Ramsey, and she's like, that, golden haired goddess, right, that everybody, she was like one of my first teachers. But I also love Randa Kamal, who's like, pure Egyptian and like really, strong and powerful in her dance, which is not something you would have seen 20 years ago, right? Those hard jutting lines and sharp accents, that wasn't a part of the dance when I started. It was ooey gooey and like, you had your accents, but it was with Umm Kulthum and she was, so soft and like, that passion, right? So it's very, very different in that sense. But I mean, sort of going back to your question, like who gets hurt? It's, very difficult for, I think, women of color to really get a chance and that opportunity to fully experience the dance or present the dance form, right? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the other piece, too, is that, besides having your voice heard, money is also in play in this point. And mm-hmm. so, folks who are essentially not white, and especially folks who are from the cultural background where we're getting this beautiful dance from aren't necessarily making the money from the dance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. But also, I'll throw something else in there just to kind of add a little bit of fire to it. A lot of the women from the regions that, you know, the dance comes from think they already can dance. And so they don't spend the time and energy and money into like lessons and that sort of thing. I experienced that a lot. Oh, well, I should start in your advanced class because I'm Lebanese or I'm whatever, right? And so, yeah, you know, maybe that's a little bit of a side to it. And so there's, you know, people that got offended that, you know, that blonde haired woman is getting the gigs in the restaurant, but maybe she spent the last 10 years going to class four nights a week and, you know, has paid her dues and that sort of thing. So there's that side of the conversation as well, right? So not everybody knows everybody's story, you know?
Oh, sure. All right. So, you know, we've talked a little bit about some of the controversy around this. Are there any other reasons why you feel like this tends to be a controversial topic rather than one that we all just talk about calmly?
Yeah, it'd be nice if everybody would talk about it calmly, because then I think a lot more resolutions would happen. But I think people get sort of offended as soon as the conversation comes up. And so they have their, you know, mindset already in place without actually listening to the other side of the story, right? So for me, like I said, I'm generally very neutral about it. I don't, you know, I just try to like, you know, listen on everything that's happening. I have my own opinions, of course, but I think for the most part, like I saw this on Facebook like quite a while ago, and I mean, I think Facebook is the major forum for this, right? But where the conversations happen. But you know, somebody is writing, you know, a little comment about like, oh well, you know, don't steal my culture, and then the other person's like, oh well, no, I'm trying to appreciate your culture, and then it just spirals because nobody's actually listening to each other's side. I think that's where the issue is. Right. It's again, you know, coming back to education and, you know, really trying to understand each person's perspective, because that person who's, you know, going to class every week and learning about the music and learning about the culture or the history or whatever the case may be, only has, you know, what she's learning to guide her or him. Right. So you might be in class and you might not have that same opportunity to go and study with five teachers. Like Toronto, for example, is, you know, inundated with different teachers from all different backgrounds. And, you know, you could learn Turkish dance one day and then go and learn Sufi the next and then go do Saidi with an Egyptian master. And you know what I mean? So like a lot of people in areas like that, you know, have those different kinds of exposure, right? Whereas, you know, in smaller towns and that sort of thing, you might not. And so it's the responsibility, I think, of that person who might feel like there's like sort of that, you know, quote unquote, misappropriation of the culture, right? It's that person's responsibility to be like, oh, well, you know what, I really appreciate the fact that you love my culture so much that you want to express it and you want to perform it and you want to become more involved with it. But did you know that if you wear a bindi, you're actually, you know, representing a different culture? Maybe that person didn't know that. You know what I mean? Maybe that person just needs that awareness, that education. That's like one of the things I always teach in seminars is, you know, I spend a lot of time, you probably remember back in May, you know, I spent a lot of time in the beginning of class talking about exactly why the music is the music used for that specific dance and why the moves are done that way and what the social construct is in that region. You know what I mean? So I spent a lot of time bringing awareness to, you know, the dancers that I'm teaching. Whereas I could just go and be like, okay, we're going to do shabi now. Let's dance. This music's really pumping. But then the next week, they're going to go take those shabi moves and, you know, do like an Umm Kulthum song or like a pop song to it. And it's completely inappropriate in a sense, right? But, you know, if they weren't aware that that's inappropriate, then how is it that person's fault that they're misappropriating the culture? Do you see what I'm saying?
Totally. Yeah. If I can like chime in just a little bit off topic for a second, you know, anytime I touch on this stuff with my own students, they're always like, this is awesome. And I'm always like, you know, how much time can I really spend in class when we're not moving? Mm-hmm. And I'm always like loath to talk too much, but right. Every time I do, like they're always happy. I think we sometimes underestimate our students and what they're interested in. And like, I feel like, you know, some people just want to do something pretty and move and flit around in a pretty costume, but I feel like an awful lot of people come to this dance because they want a cultural experience and a creative experience, and often getting that background information enhances that for them.
Absolutely.
Rather than being a distraction.
100%, Nadira. I think that a lot of people, in my experience, start for the fitness. They want to get back into fitness, or they want to get back into movement in some form. But, you know, maybe like a spin class is too hard or too intimidating or whatever. And then it's pretty and there's pretty music and it's like, oh, all the girls are getting together. We're going to do something fun and silly together. You know, that kind of attitude, right? But I find that you're absolutely right. As soon as, you know, that first song comes on and you're like, hey, did you know this is from Upper Egypt? And people used to do this and that, you know, like just people, the students just become obsessed with it. You know, it's like you can learn the movements and you can be incredible at technique, but unless you have a true understanding and awareness of, you know, the dance form and where it comes from, I think you never really are truly expressing, you know, your full potential, right?
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you know, coming back to, you know, the discussion at large, what are some of the different arguments and perspectives that you've seen going around?
Oh, gosh. I mean, here we go, right? Oh, man. So, like, you know, usually when I start seeing a conversation happen, I know it's going to go on for, like, you know, days and days. So I'll usually just skim through. But I think that the major thing that I see, and I mean, there are so many different perspectives on this, but the major arguments that I see is about, it comes down to color, okay? Which is really unfortunate when you think about this dance form that comes from an area, you know, the Middle East is covered in every different type of ethnicity. There are, you know, Black Egyptians, there are, you know, Caramello, like myself, right? Like there's a white, blonde-haired Lebanese. Like, I mean, my own cousins have red hair and green eyes. Do you know what I'm saying? So my grandmother was a blonde, right? And you look at me, you never expect that. But I mean, we come from a culture where it's every color of the rainbow, right? So many different dialects, so many different types of dance, so many different cultural experiences, so many different folk dances, that sort of thing. But what I think the major argument comes down to, oddly enough, is color of your skin. And it's like, that doesn't even have anything to do with the culture itself. So I think this is where people are getting distracted by the actual, distracted away from the actual issue of cultural misappropriation, right? So I think that, and I could be totally wrong, but this is just sort of my viewpoint, because I'll see, you know, an Arab woman start talking about, well, you are disrespecting my culture, and just because I'm a minority, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, no, I understand that. I'm a minority myself. But then there's the, you know, the other side of the coin where it's like, oh, well, just because I'm white, you think I'm not allowed to do your dance. And it's like, who's taking ownership? That's the other argument that happens. It's like, who owns the dance? You know, we all do, but, you know, just like anything, we have to respect it, right? You know, you don't go into, I don't know, what's a good example here? I was going to say something naughty, but maybe I won't. We'll just leave it at that. No, I'm just kidding. But no, I mean, you know, like you wouldn't go into like, you know, a Buddhist temple with your shoes on, because that's inappropriate. You might by mistake because you didn't know, but then somebody is going to tell you and you don't do it again, right? So it's that kind of thing in the dance form. I mean, I'm not going to go so extreme as like, you know, it's a religious dance. I don't think it is at all. It's just, it's purely based on like, you know, folk. And I think a lot of the dance form is based around socio-political constructs and I think a lot of people kind of take that to the next degree when they're arguing about it. It's like, oh, well, you know, who takes ownership of the dance? Well, I've taken your dance here in North America and I've brought it to the mainstream. So therefore I own it. Well, do you really? Do you, if you don't understand it completely? And then there's the other side of the coin where it's like, okay, well, I've brought the dance form into the mainstream and I do understand it. I've been to Egypt 10 times and I've studied with all the masters and that sort of thing. And it's like, okay, so now you've put a little bit of, you know, a little bit more standing behind your words, right? But again, you still don't own it. None of us own it, you know? Like I said, I'm an Iraqi-born Canadian who learned how to dance as a teenager. Mind you, I did like, you know, a little bit of dancing, but I went and studied. But I also, I don't do really Iraqi dance. Like I don't do Iraqi Arab dances. I do Iraqi gypsy dances and I do Egyptian dance and that's what I'm known for. But I don't do like the Iraqi Arab dances. So, you know, again, like I don't own it. I do the Egyptian style because I love it. I think it's amazing. I don't do Lebanese or Turkish because they don't speak to me the same way, but some women do, right? So I'm digressing again, but you know, that's sort of, I think those are the two perspectives that I see is like, who owns the dance, number one, and you know, does your color determine, you know, who has more you know, more standing on the dance form, right? Mm-hmm.
You know, since you brought up the color issue, I think it's a good time to mention the article that was floating around a couple years ago by Rhonda Girard. I think it was Why I Hate White Belly Dancers.
Right, yeah.
And I feel like that did a lot of good in that it got us talking about this, but it also got a lot of people really upset. And, you know, one of the things that I really feel like I was observing as all of this was going around was that, you know, things that people had been saying over and over again, but not necessarily being listened to, all of a sudden got listened to when somebody made the most extreme and angry statement possible.
Right.
You know, have you experienced, you know, that kind of, you know, you get more flies with honey, but when you say something in a brusque way, everybody shuts you down.
Yeah, absolutely. I think like you hit the nail on the head there. You know, this goes for every aspect of life, right? Like, you know, why are you saying something just to piss somebody off? Like, you know, you have your opinion, but there's a way to express it. And there's a way to still show respect, like to say that, you know, again, like that comment, why I hate white belly dancers. Like, no, that's, there are a lot of white belly dancers that are also a part of like, you know, the Arab culture, like, you know, I would say like Fifi Abdu back in her heyday was like pretty white. Like she has green eyes and, you know, she dyes her hair black, right? There are a lot. Amani is another one, right? There are a lot of dancers who are white. But anyway, that's besides the point. That article spoke to the Western woman, right? And I don't remember every part of the article, but I think that, you know, yeah, she got people talking about it, but not in a positive way. It created a defensive attitude and also this divide between Arab dancers and the average Western dancer, right? And I think that, you know, yeah, she got us talking and everybody, it kind of came to the forefront, but there's a lot of anger right now. And I think that anger has extended even to this point where I still hear people talking about the color issue and that sort of thing. And, you know, I think that it's because of the way she phrased it versus being like, you know, just like, because the article itself had a lot of really valid points, I think, and a lot of points that went both ways, both sides of the story. It's just the title was just, it just created a divide. That's my opinion on that, is it created a divide between, you know, the Arab dancers and the, you know, the average Canadian. And I see that a lot for a couple of my friends in, you know, back in Ontario, that, you know, have, you know, Middle Eastern background and that sort of thing. And they're not taken quite as seriously because of this divide, right? Or they weren't at the time. It's like, oh, well, everything that, you know, my one particular friend would say was looked upon by, you know, everybody else in the dance community, like, oh, well, she just thinks she's the best because she's, you know, from the Middle East, or, you know, she thinks she can, like, you know, go and say whatever she wants because she's from the Middle East. Well, guess what? I've studied with this person, and it's just this crazy, like, defensive environment that has come about now, you know. I think it's still there. A lot of people don't really like bring it up anymore, but I think that divide is still there, you know?
Well, one of the other things that was very helpful for me to learn coming out of all this discussion was that, you know, a lot of people were kind of coming in and saying, well, you know, we've been saying this for years and nobody listens to us until somebody writes a really inflammatory article. You know, when we say things nicely, we get ignored. Mm-hmm. When we say things, you know, more bluntly, then all of a sudden we're the angry person who's unreasonable.
Yeah, right. Right. You know what, though? I feel like that article probably would have still gotten, you know, read, because there aren't a lot of really, really good, solid researched articles out there. So I think, like, most belly dancers, like, scour the papers and the, you know, the internet and that sort of thing to find really good informative articles. So I think that article probably would have still, you know, made its rounds. But there's this culture that we have now with, you know, media being the way it is. And so being able to expose or to get, excuse me, exposure so easily, it's almost like those BuzzFeed articles where, you know, like, it's like, how do I get the most people to read this and make it go viral? And everybody wants it, things to go viral, right? So it's like, okay, I'm going to say some like really inflammatory shit, excuse my language, but you know, I'm going to say something, like you said, really inflammatory, just to see how many people are going to read about it and how many people are going to write about it and, you know, that sort of thing. And you know what? It worked. A lot of people wrote articles about it and they did get talking, but now there's this crazy divide between us. It's interesting.
So in terms of healing that divide, you know, I feel like more open discussion is probably the way forward. But, you know, why do you feel like sometimes that's so hard to do? Why do those rifts persist?
You know what, I think it comes back down to what I was saying a little bit earlier about, you know, people automatically expecting an argument, being super defensive. And so, you know, as soon as somebody starts the conversation, or somebody might say something out of anger, you know, maybe they had a personal experience and, you know, they make a little comment on Facebook or something like that, or they'll see, you know, like Beyonce dancing to Kalsum in like, you know, a thong, and then they're like, oh my gosh, okay, well, she's appropriating my culture, I better start something now, right? So, I mean, and, you know, like, you should speak up for things that, like, you know, bother you and that sort of thing. But what happens is, because of this, you know, divide that there already is, as soon as somebody, you know, makes a comment on their feelings about something, somebody else is like, oh, well, why is that person saying that? It must be directly against me. It must be directly against, like, what I'm trying to represent. And so now this argument starts, and it's this vicious circle, right? It's just the same conversation over and over and over again. Without anybody actually listening to each other. And so I think that's where we need to change. We need to change the format of our conversation. So it's not a circle, but it's a straight line that we can say, okay, so this is how I feel about it. What do you think? And that person, like, actually stops and listens and says, okay, well, you know what? Maybe this person has an understanding because of, you know, their experience. Maybe they went to Egypt 10 times. Maybe they studied with somebody who is really well versed in it. And, you know, they have that kind of backing. But everybody has, you know, I think it's really difficult to get out of that mindset. You know, we have gotten out of sort of like this belly dance sisterhood that there used to be, right? And now it's like, no, I know what I'm talking about, so you better listen. Oh, you don't want to listen? So I'm going to, you know, trash you because you clearly don't know what you're talking about. It's that kind of mentality that's happened.
Instead the belly of, like, dance this, police.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. The belly dance police. Ain't nobody need no popo. All right. So let's just back it on up. All right. We don't need the police. We don't need the belly dance police. If you don't know something, you know, just like anything in life, you didn't know how to drive, so you learned, right? You didn't know how to do a shimmy, so you learned. Maybe you are starting a conversation and somebody says, hey, like, Beyonce is dancing to Kalsum. It's like, oh, well, why would that be offensive? Well, this is the mother of, you know, sort of like the culture. This is where the culture changed. As soon as Kalsum came into the world, right? As soon as her music and her voice, it changed the whole dynamic of the culture and it changed the perspective of the culture. And so somebody dancing to a thong, to Kalsum, that could be very, very insulting towards the culture. Okay, well, now I understand, because now I can put myself in those shoes And I've learned and I've educated myself about why that might be, instead of just sort of being like, oh, well, this person just wants to be angry. Well, why are they angry, right? We do that with everything, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I feel like, you know, in terms of, you know, making progress as a community, this kind of belly dance police issue is one of the things that throws a little bit of a monkey wrench in all of this, because, you know, if we're trying to, you know, educate each other and help each other along in this process, there's always, you know, kind of the risk of putting yourself in that, well, I know this and you don't know that, and you right. must do it my way kind of thing. And so there's some people who actually do that because they enjoy being the expert, enjoy being in control, whether they're right or not. Right. And then there are folks who are just like trying to help everybody do better. And then there are folks who kind of feel like who are so afraid of being in that position that they don't speak up when they see an opportunity to kind of be a force for good. Yeah. Do you have any suggestions in that area? I'm sure it's just as true for folks from an Arab background as from those of us who aren't.
Yeah. You know what? I can speak from my own experience. I very often don't get involved in those conversations. The main reason I don't is because, like, I don't have time. I'm, you know, like, everybody just wants to keep talking about it. And it's like this circle again, right? So like, oftentimes, I won't get involved in the conversations because I know it's going to go on for days and days, right? And it's like, you know what, that's good. We should have a conversation as opposed to an argument. I think that's the issue, is like, before you start typing, just like before you start speaking, right? Think about what you're about to say, think about what you're about to write. Right? Like, does what you have to say have a foundation? Does, you know, obviously everybody's opinion completely matters, right? But are you stating your opinion, and will it offend people? Will it, like, is it based on actual fact, that sort of thing, you know? And this goes to both sides of the coin, right? Like, those who have been dancing for 30, 40 years who, you know, believe they have all the knowledge. Maybe they do, but you know what? Think about how you're phrasing it. We are, you know, we are on a format. I find it, it's a lot of it is like, you know, conversations on Facebook and that sort of thing. So we're using a format where there's no tone and there's no body language. And so, you know, an innocent comment phrased wrongly, phrased like, you know, in the wrong way might be construed as offensive, right? So how are you writing it? How are you projecting yourself? How do you want people to view you, right? You want people to view you as, you know, like that person who has the background, has the education, but will still accept, you know, somebody else's opinion, you know? I'm sure you've done this too, Nadira, where, you know, somebody will ask you a question, you'll give your opinion, and, you know, they might be like, oh, well, you know what, I don't think that's right. And you're like, okay, well, you know what? I shared my knowledge with you, and that's the end of it. You're not going to keep hammering them on the head until they finally concede to, you know, whatever your opinion is, right? I think that's the issue, is the same people are going over and over again, well, no, you're wrong. I'm right. 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 So, you know what? Maybe you're both wrong, right? So, like, let's take a step back. Maybe you're both right, you know, but, you know, I think, yeah, just kind of taking that breather before you start typing, I think that will make a big difference, right? Or maybe like give a call to your mentor and be like, hey, you know, like, I really want to get involved in this conversation. But before I do, you know, what's your opinion? Get a second opinion, right? Mm-hmm. That's why you have teachers, because they do know better sometimes. And maybe like talking it out to somebody the way we're talking about it, right? Maybe talking about it out loud instead of just typing angrily and getting, you know, angrier and angrier as the days progress, you know, is a better way to go about it, right?
Mm-hmm. And if you are in, let's say, the teacher role, does that change?
I think so. I think, yeah, you definitely have to kind of, you know, conduct yourself a little bit differently if you're the teacher, right? You know, it's your responsibility to share the correct knowledge, because otherwise it becomes, well, so-and-so told me this, and then that person has now shared it with another person, and that'll kind of keep going and going and going, right? But maybe that info wasn't correct. So it's your responsibility as a teacher to be very clear about you know, what your limits are, right? So, you know, I never teach Turkish dance, I never teach Lebanese dance, even though I understand the music, but I've done a couple of workshops, but I don't go in and teach those dance styles unless I have truly understood them and they've become a part of me, right? But a lot of people kind of, you know, they might do a workshop here or there, and then go and teach a workshop themselves in that subject, right? But when you first started dancing, you know, you spent years hopefully honing the craft and really becoming strong within that one specific genre of dance, right? And then you started to learn the folklores, and then you started to learn, you know, the different aspects, and then maybe you fell in love with Lebanese style or Turkish style or Egyptian style, or maybe you fell in love with fusion and you've, you know, adopted, like, you know, that whole side of things, that sort of dark, you know, gothic side of things, and, like, you know what I mean, like, I think it's the responsibility of the teacher to really be clear with, again, what they do actually know. So, you know, if you have only ever studied Egyptian dance, like classical Egyptian, you know, the Oriental style, that sort of thing, maybe just teach that. Maybe just be like, you know what, if your student asks you a question, maybe just be like, you know what, I don't really know, but I know somebody who might know the answer for you. I think a lot of dancers are embarrassed if they don't know everything, because everybody wants to be the master, right? Well, we can't. So I think it's really important to just, like, know your own limitations and be like, hey, you know what? I'm not sure, but I'm going to find out for you. Mm-hmm. Right?
I've also had teachers come back and correct things that they told me when they learned differently later on. And I always had, like, a huge amount of respect for that.
Absolutely. Because could you imagine, Adira, if that teacher never came back to you and you have your beautiful radio show and you're talking about things that she didn't correct herself on? It'd be a little bit embarrassing. And I think that's what happens to a lot of people, is like their teachers are too embarrassed to, you know, tell them that they were wrong about something. And so now we have these people that are like, oh my gosh, well, why would you think I'm wrong? I was definitely told this by somebody, right?
I think it also helps when somebody that you look up to shows you their process of learning and growing. Yeah. And it makes it more comfortable for you to do the same thing. So you don't feel like you have to be as perfect all the time. Exactly. And you just keep trying to learn and grow.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. We live in a world where perfection is the most important thing, right? That took me many years to kind of get over, and I'm still not always over it, right? I'm always trying to be perfect at everything, but you know what? You can't. And I think, yeah, you're right. Like having that honesty within yourself and being able to, you know, just, you know, own it, own that you were incorrect about something, but you've changed that and you've learned and you've educated yourself, right?
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you know, looking towards, you know, solutions and ways to improve, you know, what are some of the specific problems that we have to solve as a community to do better about this whole issue?
100% education. Again, like I know I've spoken about it already, but that's one of the things that I notice when I'm traveling around and teaching, because I'm not teaching in just like one area. I've taught all over North America. And every single city that I go to has a different set of understanding, right? And a lot of times the lack of understanding, I should say, a lot of times that just comes from ignorance, right? Or not delving further into it. A lot of the focus on Middle Eastern dances are the movements, which obviously, like every dance form, that's the case. You want to learn the technique, you've got to get that down. But then there is the disconnect to understanding the culture, understanding the social construct of why that dance exists. Every dance that you do, from Oriental, classical Egyptian Oriental dance to, like, you know, street shabi to Saidi, every single one of them has a social context behind it and why that dance form actually started, right? So a lot of people aren't aware of that. They're like, oh, well, it's a folk dance. So, you know, this is the music we're going to use. That's the other thing, is not understanding the music or the rhythms. I think what I would suggest for most people is to like really start to learn your rhythms. And maybe you're going to start with one or two, but even in classical Egyptian dance, which you're 100% aware of, is you're going to have, you know, sometimes 5, 6, 7 different rhythms playing in one oriental song. If you're doing like a full, you know, like 30-minute, 40-minute show, you're going to have one song that extends for that 30, 40 minutes with several different rhythms. And if you don't understand, you know, a Khaliji rhythm and you start doing a Saidi movement to it, you're going to look silly to everybody who does understand that. So, you know, educating yourself about the rhythms, the music, even if it's like 5 minutes a day, listen to one type of music and really start to understand it. Dr. George Sawa in Canada has a really useful book. The name is not coming to me right now, but Dr. George Sawa, look him up. He has a book that he's created for dancers with 2 CDs that come in it, and it has all of the different rhythms broken down on the CDs as well. The rhythms are played for you so you know exactly what they sound like on their own, and then he puts in some melody on top of that, and so you can learn to hear what it sounds like with melody, right? Because a lot of rhythms sort of sound similar, like Baladi and Saidi sound very similar, but they're very different dances that you're going to do, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, just that would be my major suggestion is like, you know, again, education. So understanding if you're going to do a Saidi dance, the major one that I'm going to just throw out there for all of you guys doing a Saya or the cane dance, a Saya and Saidi are completely different from each other. You need to be able to differentiate why they're different. So you're not doing an Saya to a Saidi song, right? It's inappropriate. That's where that, you know, cultural appropriation comes in, even like on a deeper level, like within, you know, the dance and the music itself, right? So where was I going with that? I just like go on tangents. So, you know, like the major thing is like, if you really truly love the dance form, you know, just like anything you truly love, you want to understand it. Like you guys, when you get your new boyfriend, right? Like you are like, you want to learn everything about him to like his ex-girlfriend, and you're on Facebook and you're like, you know, I mean, you learn everything about that, right? So, you know, why don't we do that with the dance form that we love so much and we want to express, right? We want to do it justice, right? So educating yourself. And if you feel like, you know, this is the other thing I'm just going to throw out there. If you feel like your teacher is not giving you everything that you want from that side of it, whether it's like, for example, maybe some teachers are stronger in technique than in musicality. So maybe you go to one teacher for the technique and another teacher to understand musicality and so on, right? Don't be afraid of, you know, going and experiencing that with other people. I think that's how you grow as a dancer and learning and how to learn how to develop your own voice as a dancer, right?
Mm-hmm. All right. So, you know, are there any specific ways that you recommend to get more background and more education for yourself in addition to studying with other teachers?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, you know, reading. Reading is a good one. There are a lot of really good sources out there. And a lot of times there are, you know, maybe somebody who hasn't done like the complete research. And so you read 5 or 6 different sources and you come to like the, you know, the major consensus of what, you know, you're trying to achieve, what you're trying to understand. The other thing is, you know, talk to people from that region. I found that a lot of my understanding of the music and really getting into depth with the music actually came from my dad. You know, like I'd be like, you know, Dad, what's this song really about? You know, what's this music really about? And, you know, I learned a lot about musicality just from him. Go and learn how to play an instrument. Probably the best way to learn rhythms is to go and do like a drumming class. Become proficient at, you know, the dumbek, you know, the goblet-shaped drum that is used in pretty much every Middle Eastern song, every Arabic song anyway, right? Learning the music that way, you know, pick up a kanun or pick up an oud, or even go on YouTube and just like, you know, tap it out on your thighs, right? Or just listen to it on your thighs, listen to how they speak about it, the music and the rhythms that way, right? There are so many different ways. Oh my goodness. If you are doing gigs already, you're most likely doing a gig at like, you know, a Greek restaurant or an Arabic restaurant, Middle Eastern restaurant of some form, a Turkish restaurant. So why not talk to the owners about it? Why not go and like, you know, talk to the patrons and just be like, hey, you know, like, what did you think of my show? What did you think of the song choice? Right? If you guys are doing gigs, you know, like weddings or something with people from that area, you know, maybe ask them what kind of song they want and why they've chosen those songs, right? So there are a lot of different ways. What do you think?
Well, I think one thing that is sometimes an issue is finding people to talk to.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, I think especially when you're in that like kind of professional context, especially when you're newer, yeah. You know, that I have to be perfect all the time thing,
yeah,
can prevent people from asking questions. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of those places where, you know, especially if you're not, you know, in a place to get over that just yet, the internet can really help.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, especially there are a lot of, you know, like message boards where people will post song translations who aren't necessarily dancers and aren't necessarily in this kind of like insular dancer culture. But I've also learned some really interesting things on musicians forums. So, you know, I have, speaking of getting to playing an instrument, you know, on my list, but not at the top of my list right now, is learning to play Turkish clarinet.
Oh, nice.
And so for months, I was just like reading everything I could just to find out whether I needed a special type of clarinet, which was like the big gateway. And then right. I started taking Turkish language classes. And so all of my practice time is like studying time. But, you know, I spent like 3 or 4 months just like combing through this forum. And I picked up so much interesting stuff there. I wasn't even participating. I was just reading.
Right, exactly.
And so I feel like that's, for a lot of people, kind of a safer place to start.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely.
Yeah,
it's so good. I love this dance so much. There's so much you can talk about and so much you can do. I mean, like, I wish there was a video, you know, part of this the station, then we could just like all dance together and jam together right now. Maybe that's next for you, an online live show.
Maybe sometime. Yeah. All right. Well, I think maybe this is a good time to start moving on to our next segment. So we're going to open this up for questions and answers from our listeners in a second. But before we do that, was there anything that you wanted to talk about that I didn't give you an opportunity to say?
No, I'm pretty sure I even spoke about things that I probably shouldn't have with all my digressions. So
I don't think so. I think we're all good there.
Right on.
You know, and if people take one thing away from this call, if they learn one thing or remember one thing, what would you want that to be?
Oh gosh, I think take everything with a grain of salt, right? Everything that you read, everything that you hear, you know, especially when it comes to misappropriation of cultures, is that, you know, maybe somebody is like bringing something up because they want to draw it to your attention, you just weren't aware, right? So, you know, take everything that you read and see and hear with a grain of salt, but also, you know, look into how you can educate yourself further on validating the art form in the way that it's meant to be.
Mm-hmm. And if folks want to learn more from you, how can they do that?
Well, the website is being built right now, so it will eventually be bellyloves.com. Or maybe not. Well, that's the goal anyway. It should be built pretty soon. The other way you can reach me is bellyloveinfo@gmail.com. For now, that's sort of the easiest way to get a hold of me. Of course, Facebook and Instagram. So Facebook, I'm under Hiba Heather Elkanani. And you can find that info under Belly Love with Hiba on Facebook, and Hiba Butterfly on Instagram. So, you know, a lot of different ways you can get a hold of me. Please feel free to anytime. I'm not the fastest with emails, but I do try.
All right. And you've mentioned that you travel pretty much anywhere to teach. We met in North Dakota. So I assume that if folks want to bring you to their town, they can just get in touch with you.
Absolutely. Yeah. Shoot me an email and we'll make it work.
And you have online teaching as well, right?
I do. I have the Belly Love Chorus, which is an interesting course. We start from the basics and move our way through basically every aspect every month. So you usually have four course modules, a personal phone call with me on you know, what you want to progress with, where you want to go in the dance, how the last you know, month went, and also a video session. And get in touch. Send me an email if you're interested in learning more about that. But it's a pretty interesting course for everybody who's listening today. If you sign up for the course, which should be up and running by the end of January, you'll get free access to our retreat, which I'll tell you more about later if you send me an email. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
And what kinds of things do you cover in your course?
So it starts with movement, culture, musicality, basically every aspect from beginning to end of the dance form. So we start very basic with your movements the first month and just grow individually. So you'll have course modules that, you know, focus on musicality, that focus on the movement, but also focus on the culture, socio-political aspects behind the dance form. So it's quite a intense immersion into the dance form. And then, like I said, you do get, you know, a personal phone call with me, as well as a, you know, a one-on-one session via Skype or whichever type of media you have.
Cool.
Live.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, so why don't we go ahead and open this up to questions from our listeners. So those of you who are just listening on the webcast, if you click on the little question bubble, oh, no, that's not the right one. Hang on. If you click on the little speech bubble on the right, that will pop out a little panel on the right, and you can type in your question there. If you're on the phone, you can press star star to unmute yourself. And if you're on Skype, you can press star star on your Skype keypad. So you've got a question, we'd love to hear it. If you'd like to share your favorite tidbit that you picked up, or you'd like to share a challenge that you've had around this, we would love to hear from you. Hi there.
Hi, this is Kava. Sorry about my voice. Whatever is going on, going around in D.C. is also in California.
Oh, I
feel you. So I'm a bit scared to ask this, but I was interested in your perspective about dancers who aren't Arab taking Arabic names.
Oh, you know what? This is, it's so great. Sorry, what was your name again?
It's Hava.
Hava? Nice to meet you. It's a really great question. It was actually something I was thinking about earlier today and totally forgot to mention it. So I'm glad you brought it up. I actually think it's really awesome when somebody who's not of Arabic descent takes an Arabic name. And I've often given names to my students who've, you know, asked to kind of get to that next level. And I think that that's a true demonstration of the appreciation of the culture. Whereas, you know, and it's totally fine, you can have whatever stage name you want to have, but I find that a lot of people who, you know, stick with you know, their, you know, quote unquote Western names, right? Or, you know, whatever name, are maybe kind of sort of like, I want to say like fighting the power. They don't want to completely assimilate into the culture. So they keep their original name, right? But those who are taking Arabic names are really, to me, showing or demonstrating appreciation of the culture.
Well, thank you. That is perspective I haven't heard before.
Oh, I'm glad.
Yeah. Also, I just wanted to know what's the name of, and how can I watch the movie that, or whatever it was? Is it a movie, a show about about how Oriental dance is stigmatized in Arabic culture?
Oh, yeah. It's, you know what? I don't even think it's online because it was made back in the DVD days. So I'm not sure if she's ever put it online, but it's called It's No Hoochie Coochie. And a filmmaker in Guelph, Ontario named Mary Lalonde actually made it. So maybe if she gets enough emails, she'll put it online for you. But it's called Rax Sharkey, It's No Hoochie Coochie. and really kind of goes into a little bit more depth about the controversy of what I was talking about, like at the beginning of the call. I don't know if you were listening in at that time or not, but at the beginning of the call, I was talking about how I was trying to get into, the Arabic culture a little bit more and really kind of delve into it and feel more Arab myself. But I was kind of stopped short, and it was a very difficult time period for me because I loved the dance so much, but I wasn't accepted by anybody in my family. My mom was a different story, but like my dad had a really hard time with it, and his friends were looking down upon me and that sort of thing. So it really delves into that side of the culture. It's interesting because it's like every Arab loves belly dance, loves Middle Eastern dance, they love all the dancers, but not if their daughter does it, not if their cousin does it, it's very shameful to have a family member do that, until of course that point where they become rich and famous and a movie star, then it's all good. Just like every artist, right? Every artist who's like, oh, well, you probably shouldn't be a painter because you're not going to make any money. Then you become rich and famous and everybody loves you, right? So it's that kind of thing.
So can you tell me her name again? Mary, what was her name?
Mary Lalonde.
Lamond?
Lalonde, Lalonde. I hope that's okay with her. I didn't ask for permission, but I'm sure it's fine. Just you can find her on Facebook. Ask her to put it online.
Dr. George, what was his last name about the rhythm CDs?
Yeah, Dr. George Sawa, Sawa.
And if I can break in for a second, I found it. It's Egyptian Music Appreciation and Practice for Belly Dancers.
Yep, exactly. That's the one. Thank you.
And I don't know if this is public, so I probably shouldn't say this, but he's having a holiday sale right now. So get in touch with him.
Great. Yeah, you guys, it's honestly like one of the booklets that I've pretty much forced every student of mine to buy because it's just like it breaks it down so perfectly for every dancer. It's designed for belly dancers. So, you've got all the rhythms just broken down for you. And then, you can start to listen for that in all of your favorite old songs, all of the Om Kalsum and Farid El Atrash and all the songs that like you're generally going to be listening to. Once you're able to identify the rhythms, you can really start to express yourself as a dancer.
Well, thank you for that information.
Pleasure. Let me know how it goes for you, okay? And tell George I sent you.
Thanks, Ava.
Thank you.
All right. If anybody else would like to ask a question or share something, go ahead and press ** to unmute yourself. Hi there.
Hi. My name is Majida. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, Hiba. Hi, Nazira. I love your program.
Thank you.
I have a few comments or questions. First, it's about tips. I grew up in the Middle East, and I've seen weddings, etc. But I haven't seen this type of practice. Some of the dancers I admire so much, but when I see all the tips tucked into the costume, it's a practice that I'm not sure about. I, of course, don't do it because I grew up as a Muslim and in a conservative society, and it's become such a part of me, and it really, I can't change that too much. I wonder how, what your thoughts are on that.
Me or Nadira?
Oh. Either it's a general question. I guess you're the guest, so.
Oh, okay. Well,
all the controversial questions go to you.
I get to. We'll keep Nadira. We'll keep Nadira safe for now. So with tipping, I'm of the same background as you. I grew up Muslim, and my opinions on that completely irrelevant right now. But I grew up in the same kind of background as you. And I think that's what made it hard for me to be a dancer, period, and kind of progressing down that path. But in terms of tipping, so I have a way around it, okay? So first and foremost, here's the thing. You have to get paid what you're worth. So I will never do a gig lower than my standing rate, whether it's, you know, a couple hundred more than everybody else or whatever the case may be. I never do a gig for less than what I can afford, if that makes sense. So you don't sell yourself short, because then if you sell yourself short, you might feel the need to have to take tips so that it makes your gigging worth it, right? So a lot of people pay for, you know, my services, for my performances, you know, because they know that's what I'm worth. They might, you know, you have the odd occasion of somebody going for a dancer who charges less, but at the end of the day, you're getting the quality gigs because you know what you're worth and you set your standard and you don't budge from it. Okay. So that's the first tip I'll give to all of you guys. Set your standard high. You know, because the more you lower it, the more your value drops and the more people are like, oh, well, you know what? She's dancing for 125 bucks. I'll just give her 100. Do you know what I mean? Then you're forced to take tips. Then you're like, oh, well, I'm here for 2 hours. By the time I get there and change and put on my lashes on and, you know, all of that stuff, you're like, I need those tips. Okay. And that's where I think a lot of dancers have, like, you know, the bills popping out of their bra and that sort of thing. Now in Canada, it's a little different because we don't have dollar bills, y'all. All right. So, so, you know, that girl might have $20, but like in Canada, somebody gives me a $20 bill, I just like, you know, hide that. There's not 20 bills there. Right. But anyway, besides the point. So basically what I do, all right, and this is a tip for all of you dancers out there, I never present a body part to anybody if they're wanting to tip me, because as a part of the culture, it is also customary and a sign of respect when somebody is trying to give you a tip. Mind you, if they're like groping your boob, that's not a sign of respect. But a lot of times in Middle Eastern culture, if you have an Arab coming up to you, it's part of the culture to tip you, right? So my little way around it is I never present a body part, because that just degrades you. That kind of, you know, that's again orientalizing the dance form, taking away from the value and beauty of it as an art form, right? So what I do is I will graciously, you know, bow, accept the tip, and then I actually build in little pockets to my costumes. So I just tuck the tip right into the pocket. So nobody can ever see a tip. If you see any of my pictures and any live performance, you'll never see any money sticking out of my bra or my skirt, right? Like I always build a little pocket into it. So I'll graciously accept, I'll do a little bow, a little thank you. And when I bow, I cover my chest anytime I'm doing a bow. You know, that's how you set yourself above, and you set, you know, you set your value a little bit higher, right? You don't sort of minimize what you're doing as an artist, right? So build in a little pocket into your skirt, or, you know, build it into your bra if you want to be a little cheeky, but like don't have money sticking out. That's just what I do. You know, if that works for you, then I hope it helps you feel a little bit better about making some extra cashola while you're at it, right? Because those lashes are expensive. You're going to buy like some expensive lashes. Like you need to pay for that somehow.
Yeah, that pocket, making a pocket really resonates. I was taking a beautiful tip jar and just setting it, but that wasn't working so well. So
you know what? And sometimes it's like that street performer thing. Like I never really like to have tip jars or anything like that, because it's like, oh, well, I guess she's not getting paid. It's a little bit awkward, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know,
yes.
If somebody wants to tip you, and a lot of times they will. Want to, right? Like you just need to plant a friend in the audience who's going to come and, like, you know, start with that $5 bill, and then everybody else is going to tip. They'll be like, oh, that guy's tipping, so I better tip also, right? That's another tip right there. Plant a friend in the audience, we'll start the tipping off.
The other comment was about the belly dance roots question. There's a lot of emphasis right now about it, Egyptian dance, and it's being the origin, but isn't it, I've learned from different teachers, there's influences, just that myself also, I have different backgrounds, so I feel like there's Indian and Persian and Arab influences. Isn't that true? Or...
You know,
it doesn't take an expert, many experts, to answer this question.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you my opinion on it. And sort of like my research behind it, and I'll just sort of like throw a little Iraqi thing in there. It's like everybody thinks it started in Iraq. Okay, I just have to say that. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. the reality is, belly dance as we know it is an evolution of all of the different folkloric styles meshed into one, right? So what was in the 20s a folkloric style of dance at Little Egypt, you know, or in even in the Chicago World Fair in 1893 when Nadia, oh my gosh, I'm going to forget her name now, but Little Egypt, as we know her, right, came into Chicago and kind of started that whole Hollywoodization of belly dance. She was a Syrian dancer. She was doing a folkloric style of dance. She was gyrating a little bit and like shaking a little something, something. But, you know, it was scandalous enough that it drew attention to everything. And so what happened was, you know, the Hollywoodization and, you know, the little, that Orientalism comes into place again, right? Where it's like, oh my gosh, this is so exotic and so naughty, and let's put a bra on it, and let's put some gold on, bling on it, and that sort of thing. And they've taken sort of different elements, which was adopted into the Middle East, right? Like the bedlas and that sort of thing that they wear in Egypt right now. That's something that was adopted from the West, right? So, I mean, like, we've got that sort of that reverse action of cultures here. But in the reality is that every part of, you know, classical Egyptian dance or, you know, belly dancing as we know it, whether it's Turkey, whether it's Greece, Egypt, Lebanon, wherever, right? All stemmed from folkloric styles, right? From Shiftitali, from Saidi. You look at Egyptian style dance, the vast majority of the movements and a lot of the classical Egyptian music that you see in like belly dance with like, you know, the bras and the studded belts and that sort of thing and the fringe and all of that, that came from like folkloric styles from Saidi, from Asaya, from, you know, from Falahi, from all of the different styles. And so I think Egypt has the most emphasis right now because it's the most widely accessible. There are more dancers in Egypt. There's more music coming out of Egypt. There's more exposure. Egypt was also, you know, the first and foremost in terms of movies in the like 30s and 40s. They were on par with what was happening in North America in terms of movies. And so that's where they sort of had the edge. And that's why when people think of belly dancing, they oftentimes will first think of Egypt, right? Because of that exposure. So, but in terms of like, you know, where belly dance as we know it has come from, I don't think that there's really a source of belly dance as we know it. I think that belly dance is just like an adaptation of the local folklores, to be honest with you. That's my opinion on it. That's my take. And, you know, everybody
Thank
has.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
Thank you very much. Thank
You're
you.
You're welcome.
What I can actually add one little thing onto that. You know, when we're talking about all of these source and folklore dances, the other thing to remember is that, you know, a lot of the places where belly dance comes from were under the same rule for centuries,
yeah.
whether it was the Ottoman Empire or the various other people that ruled these. And in a lot of cases, there was a lot of exchange and mobility. So
right.
you'd have professional performers, you know, going from one country to another. And so there was a whole lot of cross-mixing. And so when we get into the question of where did it start, that's a lot harder to answer because for centuries there's been this mixing and blending and sharing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Very good point.
Thank you very much.
That was a great question. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much.
All right. Would anybody else like to ask a question? You can press ** to unmute yourself. Or your favorite thing that you learned, or the biggest thing that you've got to mull over now that you've been thinking about this?
And don't be afraid. I mean, we're going controversial here. So if you have a differing opinion, I'd love to hear it, you know?
And you can come in anonymously if you want to. I will see the city that you're from, but not necessarily your name. And I won't say it if you don't want me to say it. Hi there.
Hi, Nadira. It's Mariana. Hi, Hiba.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Thanks. Having fun.
Good. My question touched kind of on what you had talked about in learning the rhythms and taking either Dzumbik class or Qanun or Oud, whatever you choose, so to speak. But mine was more, how important do you think it is for dancers to learn Arabic when it comes to either understanding song lyrics or traditional pieces like Om Kulthum, or just even pop songs that they're using for fun performance, what have you, to just kind of get a level deeper than just the dance. You know, it is a culture, it's a language, it's a people, it's bigger than just belly dance.
I love this question. I love it. I spend a lot of time translating songs for students, and I think that learning Arabic, or even learning just, enough to kind of get the gist of things, will make a huge difference for dancers. I think, interestingly enough, belly dance is the only dance form that people don't completely immerse themselves in. So I know a lot of ballroom dancers will learn Spanish, and the list goes on with different dance forms, right? So I think that, getting the gist of Arabic, mind you, like some people aren't doing Arabic dance. They might be doing Turkish, like Nadira is learning Turkish right now, right? So I think that that's very important because I've seen, like, I can't even count the number of times that I've seen somebody, dancing to an incredibly sad song that's about like a loved one dying or leaving them with like the biggest jolly smile on their face and like the biggest happy movements and like, sick kicks that are like so bouncy and that sort of thing. And the song's like, I want to kill myself. I'm so sad my lover left me. You know what I mean? So even just like taking that time to understand the song that you're choreographing or the song that's speaking to you, like, I have like a little bit of a hearing issue, so sometimes I can't hear lyrics in songs, and I have to kind of stop and really listen to them, even in Arabic songs. So for me, the first thing that speaks to me is the rhythm and the melody and that sort of thing, and how it makes me feel. But oftentimes, like once you really stop and listen to a song, that song that made you feel happy is actually not very happy. And so how do you express that emotion if you don't understand what's going on in it, right? The other side of it is a lot of songs, sort of just digressing off of your question a little bit, but a lot of songs only have or have musical versions that don't have any vocals, right? But the songs themselves, a lot of Umm Kulthum songs are like pretty sad and like, about lost love, and actually a lot of Arabic songs in general are about lost love. A lot of times, like the really recognizable songs, like Inta Umri and that sort of thing, you'll have, or Lisa Fakhar, that's another one that I hear like just musical versions all the time. But if you don't understand what the song is about and you're dancing Lisa Fakhar like so happy and jolly, like the people that do understand that song or know about that song might find it a little bit odd. And so you're not expressing the music the way it should be expressed, right? And so, just to go back to your question, learning a little bit of Arabic, I think, is really helpful. Even just learning, like, the word for love, the word for death, the word for, lost love, things that might come up more often. And then you'll just find that you recognize those songs as they come into play. You're like, oh, yeah, I know Habibi means my love. Oh, I know what this means or that means, right?
And if I can put in a little pitch, a couple years ago we had Leila Lanti on the Clubhouse, and she gave us a little bit of background in exactly that. So she's got a great DVD called Habibi, You Are My What, where she goes over some of the most common words that you're likely to hear in music. So she gave us a really great preview on the call. You can start there, and she's got a great DVD which was filmed live in one of her workshops. That's a great place to start.
Love it.
Yeah. Awesome. And if you don't mind me chiming in a little bit, I'm somebody with no Arabic cultural background and no Middle Eastern cultural background, and I have been taking Turkish for 2 years. And in my case, I did it partly because I needed a hobby. when your hobby becomes your job, it takes on a whole different thing. And I'm a language geek, so for me, this is kind of fun. But it is a lot of work, and I know a lot of people get really intimidated by that. So I just really want to add an extra plug that, it really opens doors. You learn all kinds of things about the culture, about how people think. When you learn the language from somebody who's not a dancer, when you try and pick up this stuff from somebody who's not coming at from a dancer's perspective. And so there are all kinds of things that you would never learn about if you weren't interacting with somebody. And in a lot of cases, that's your teacher who has to talk to you every single week, and you have to talk about random things. But also, people are always thrilled when you make an effort. And so, if you even if you really stink at it, if you just know a little bit and you try it out, and people tend to be really happy that you're trying to learn their language, and they're always really open to, hearing your worst hello, how are you, my name is.
Exactly.
And often that's a good way to kind of make some of those friendships where you can start asking those questions that you might feel shy about in a more professional context. Every little bit
Absolutely, I
helps.
agree.
Cool. Well, I interrupted. So, Heba, were you still talking?
No, I'm good.
And Mariana, did we answer your question, or did you have any more?
No, I think it's so important, and just like you just said, especially if you work in Middle Eastern restaurants, my own experience, they are so happy to practice and help you and answer your questions. So learn Arabic.
Yeah, totally.
And if I can add another plug, I found my Turkish teacher through a service called Italki. It's
Me too.
italki.com. It is so great. If any people don't know
It's
about this,
the
it's like a matchmaking service for language
best.
learners and teachers. So everybody teaches over Skype. And because a lot of folks are living outside of North America, you tend to get people living in places where the cost of living is lower, and so you can get really reasonably priced lessons. So the only group Turkish class in town and here in Boston that I could find costs more than my private lesson over Skype. So you can
Yes.
meet up with professional teachers, you can meet up with tutors who are native speakers but not necessarily trained teachers, you can find conversation partners. It's a really great service, so I highly recommend it.
Yeah, it's a really good one. I've done that before too. And here in Vancouver, there's actually like a ton of meetup groups. So people who are all trying to learn the language will get together and practice with each other, which is sometimes less intimidating as well. So if you know a little bit of background on the language, getting together with other people that are also trying to learn it and speak to each other, that's sometimes cool too, because you can be like, hey, what's the word for this again?
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks, Mariana.
Thanks, guys.
All right. So I'm going to
Welcome.
mute Mariana again. And if anybody else would like to ask a question or share a challenge that they've had or their favorite thing that they picked up from this call, we would love to hear from you. You can press ** to unmute yourself. All right, then I think we are going to call it a night. So first off, thank you so much, Heba.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun, and I'm glad that we could meet again.
Me too. This has been a lot of fun and really informative, and I also really appreciate you being willing to talk about something controversial. I think sometimes people kind of shy away from the harder discussions, and so it really does us all a lot of good when people are willing to step up and have that conversation. So thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate
My
it.
pleasure. And
And thanks for listening.
I'd like to give another shout out to our sponsor, Alia Thabit. Again, she's the author of the upcoming book, Midnight at the Crossroads: Has Belly Dance Sold Its Soul? So if you'd like to read this love letter to the dance with its exploration of the creative, healing, and spiritual power, and a map for you to find your true style, you can check that out at bellydancesoul.com. And I do encourage you to go there, but if you're really, really on the fence, go listen to her Clubhouse appearance first. You can find that at bellydancegeek.com/clubhouse-archives. And let me also tell you a little bit more about what's going on in the Belly Dance Geek world this month. So registration is now open for how to build a sustainable practice habit. So if you find that you've been stuck in kind of a feast or famine practice cycle where you practice a lot before a gig and then not so much for a couple days or weeks or months, and you'd really rather make practice a regular part of your life, we're going to be doing a 9-week online course starting in January. And you can check that out at bellydancegeek.com/practice-habit. And I'd also like to thank everybody for coming, especially because we had a slightly later call this time. So for folks on the West Coast, I'm sure this was really convenient, but folks on the East Coast or in Europe, you're probably getting ready for bed by now. And this is the end of our call, but that doesn't mean that the conversation has to end. We've got a private Facebook group just for Clubhouse members. So I'll be sending out an email shortly, which will have a link that you can use to sign up. As always, there is going to be a little bit of an approval delay. So it's a private group to make sure that, you know, we have just dancers in there. So you will have to request to join, and it can take me a day or two to approve that. So don't worry if you can't post immediately. In my email, I'll also include a link to the call recording. So if you want to listen to this again, you can. Some links to some of the resources that we've mentioned. So Dr. George Sawa's book, etc. And I'll also include a link to the survey. That's where you can provide me with any ideas that you'd like to have for topics or speakers or any ways that I can improve the Clubhouse. And I would love to hear from you. Please also mark your calendar, because our next call is coming up on Thursday, January 26th, and Elizabeth Joy is going to be talking about her format Improv Roulette and how we can use that to build back play and joy, to bring play and joy back into our dance. And the last thing that I want to say is that this is the come on in kind of Clubhouse, not the no boys allowed kind. So if you know anybody else who would like to join us, you can invite them to do so at bellydancegeek.com/clubhouse. And until next time, happy dancing. Good night, everybody.
Good night. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for listening. For more geektacular resources, check out bellydancegeek.com.